We're here just after the end of the Oxford Real Farming Conference at the Charles Street Kitchen, where Dr. Elaine Ingham has very kindly agreed to join us for an interview. And Dr. Ingham is the president of Soil Food Web Inc., based in Oregon, and is also working with the Rodale Institute.
I was at the Rodale, yeah.
Working.
Chief scientist at the Rodale Institute from 2011 to 2013. So there for about 2.5 years.
Okay. And so, we've listened to a very insightful talk that opened the conference. And, of course, many questions arose, so we're hoping we might be able to explore some of that territory in this interview.
Great.
Yeah, and you might be pleased to hear that apparently your talk has caused some of the farmers who were present at the conference to say they've totally rethought the way they're going to think about their soils.
Yes,
so,
excellent.
A bit of a victory there.
Yeah.
Great. Right, so where shall we begin?
I think it would be good to begin with the question of tillage.
The response is, don't.
Well, indeed, and yet, as I listened to you talk, you spoke of working with farmers doing intensive annual agriculture. And so we were talking to Patrick Holden a bit earlier today, and it's been quite helpful talking to him to sort of clarify a concept that he has of a rotation in which you have a regenerative phase of soil carbon building and soil life building in the form of pasture.
Using sort of mob grazing techniques, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, an optimized pasture system where you're maximizing that quality of it, which might be seen as a bank account into which you pay a certain amount of money. And then Patrick's suggesting that once we've done that, we can afford to extract some money from this bank account. Now, you're talking about the succession of bacterial soils to bacterial fungal towards the much predominantly fungal later in succession. My first question would be, what are your thoughts on how bad tillage is if practiced in that sort of system? Because obviously we've adapted ourselves, our cultures have moved towards more and more annual crops, and even if we might want to transition away and towards more perennial crops, nonetheless people are still going to expect them. So. Yeah, I want to know how bad it is, and what's the best way of doing it? Is alley cropping the best way of doing it? Does that give refuge, etc.?
And tillage in any form is going to so disturb the soil that you typically are going to really reduce your beneficial fungal community, the protozoa and the beneficial nematodes. So you're killing some of those organisms. Not all of them. A single time tillage is not going to do that much damage. And it depends, and here's another thought, it depends on what kind of tillage you're performing. Mm-hmm. If you're doing a moldboard plow where you're basically taking a slice of your soil, what is at the surface is now going to be at 4 to 6 inches. Mm-hmm. And what was at 4 to 6 inches is now on the surface of your soil. All you've really done is kind of flip a portion of your soil. You haven't destroyed the organisms in that bed of that soil. Mm-hmm. So it's not nearly as damaging as, saying, doing rototilling.
Yeah.
You're basically completely destroying all of the structure. Most of those fungi, protozoa, and nematodes are obliterated, and microarthropods, if they were present there, have now scattered and said, run away, this giant earthquake has happened, I'm leaving, because this is not safe to live in anymore. So your beneficial nematodes are doing the same thing. So what kind of tillage? Okay. Some is much more damaging than yep. others.
So I guess the question then is, say you if you had a system where you're using shallow tillage and you're using, then you're going then to do 2 years of leaving the earth with perhaps mob grazing, holistic management kind of grazing to rebuild the organic matter. Would a rotation system like that be sustainable in terms of soil biology, or would that over the course of time still deplete the fertility and the biology, but just at a much slower rate?
If we're actually going to be tilling the whole field whenever we do tillage, you are going to be going backwards in succession, basically, because you are destroying the soil yeah. organic matter. So I think there are other ways to deal with this particular situation. If we don't till the whole field, and what we're going towards now is to put in a permanent set of understory plants.
Yeah.
You want things that are no more than 1 to 3 inches tall and completely cover that whole soil. So come springtime, when you're going to put in your rows of broccoli or your rows of corn or your rows of, you know, whatever annual crop that you're going to put in, we're only tilling that little strip where the seed goes in, but then we're leaving the 6 inches, the 9 inches, the 12 inches between this row and the next mm-hmm. one. So all of these plants are maintaining okay. the inputs of food into the soil.
Are we talking nitrogen fixers screaming your sort of plants here?
Doesn't have to be, because yeah. in fact your soil contains all the nitrogen it already needs.
So just something perennial.
Right. So something that's putting the foods back into the soil, the exudates, the detritus onto the surface of the soil. So the bacteria, fungi, protozoa, nematodes, microarthropods are maintained, not disturbed. We may be tilling this, so my microarthropods are going, run away, but they're running away to right here instead of the next field over or to the closest piece of woodland that you've got. So we're keeping that diversity within the field.
But how do you then manage those plants that are serving as soil cover? I mean, could you give me an example of what you might use in a sort of temperate system?
Dock is a good example. And most, you know, the dock that grows, you know, 3 or 4 feet high, that's not the species of dock that we want. We want the short, low-growing, very prostrate. Mm-hmm. Sedums are very good as well. There's a lot of trefoils, which is a nitrogen fixer. So we've got a list of, you know, probably about 50 understory plant species for different parts of the United States. So we have a grouping that's really good for the Southwest, another that's good for the Pacific Northwest, Midwest, North and South, and then you know, Florida, the semi-tropical areas, different set for Hawaii up in the Northeast. And some of them are, you know, universal enough that they appear in all of those groups, but then we always have things that are very specific.
Are there any qualities that are sort of universal throughout those bioregional categories? So is there something that you're going to be looking for in any circumstance?
The principles are that you don't want them growing very tall, because you don't ever want to have to be in there and mow them. Mm-hmm. We don't want to have these understory plants overshading or preventing sunlight from getting onto the cash crop. We want our cash crop, when it is put in, to get tied into that below ground network, the mycorrhizal fungi, as rapidly as possible. And what we see is the crop that we've put in, the annual crop, usually takes half the time to germinate and start to grow, because it's getting connected into this below ground system. The hormones, the materials that the bacteria, fungi, protozoa, nematodes are releasing are exactly what the plant wants. Germinates, it's popping up out of the ground in half the time. So tomatoes, it's really critical with tomatoes to get that seed germinated, get that plant growing, so you can take your tomatoes to market before anybody else. You're going to get max dollars for that tomato. Or, you know, so when are you planting them? A lot of times people will plant a succession, and we want that latest crop possible so that people continue to have that food late into the growing season. And again, you're going to get a bonus if you've got fresh green beans in October, as opposed to everybody's picked their beans and it's over and done with in mid-August. Mm-hmm. So you know, there's lots of tricks to be done. If you understand what your market is, you can start managing the system. So we always want these perennial understories. As soon as you harvest, you've got residues that go down onto the ground. And those residues will be completely decomposed and turned into soil within a 1 month period. So long before winter comes on, all of that detrital material has now been turned into soil and is going to be protecting the rest of the soil deeper than that. We've got good infiltration, we have good decomposition, we get rid of a lot of the insect diseases or disease-causing organisms that try to gain entry into our agricultural systems in that fall period. All winter long, underneath the snow, the bacteria and fungi are working and they're building structure. So come the next spring, as soon as the snow melts or as soon as your soil thaws, your understory plants start to grow and they fill in all of those strips that you put your plants into. So come the springtime, where it's really critical to protect your soil from rainfall, because the most compacting factor that we actually deal with in most soils is rainfall. When that drop of water hits bare soil, that's more compacting than the tillage that we do in many instances. When we're in tropical systems, one rainfall can cause a compaction layer bad enough to prevent roots from being able to grow deep into the soil. So that's how hard the raindrops are hitting the surface of the soil.
So you need something to absorb that, so it doesn't compact.
You need that protective layer of the leaf surfaces. Let the leaf surface absorb that that pressure of that raindrop hitting the surface instead of your soil and thus becoming compacted and thus having an anaerobic layer, and thus your roots cannot grow through that compaction layer. So we want to keep that structure within the soil. So there's the perfect way to do it.
So if I could just unpack that a little bit further. This is something that I've not heard a lot about. Interesting. I know a little of what Masanobu Fukuyaka was doing, and this this has some associations with that for me. But obviously it's different. So it seems like a sort of continuous cover arable cropping system. Now, you also mentioned the snow, because that would have been my other question, one of two questions. In this country, we can't really rely on any snow to protect the soil from erosion, or the frost indeed, to stabilize the soil over the winter time. And also, of course, there's always the grasses creeping in.
Well, typically we don't have grass creeping into that system, because we're choosing plants that are very good at complete cover.
Filling all the niches.
It's hard for weeds to move into that system because we're maintaining that fungal biomass, which is incompatible with a weed. They don't have the right form of nitrogen. These other later successional plant species are going to maintain the hold because we've got both nitrate and ammonium present as sources of soluble inorganic nitrogen, and weeds can't tolerate that. So we select against those weedy species. We don't ever have thistle. We don't ever have lamb's quarter. We don't have, the ragworts that seem to be so much of a problem, certainly in this part of the world, throughout Europe. They're selected against because they require strictly nitrates as their form of nitrogen. They're not going to win if we've got that balance of the bacteria and fungi. So maintaining that ability to prevent the invasive species from coming back into that system. Even the invasive shrubs, they require high levels of nitrate. And without that high level of nitrate, the invasive shrubs won't. They can't invade. So we get rid of a lot of those current problems that we've got because of the way we've been doing agriculture.
Sorry, one final thing. If people want to learn more of the work that's been done on this system, where would you direct them towards?
It's really something that we've been starting to develop just in the last couple of years.
Right.
So when I was at Rodale, I was trying to get them to establish, and we were doing a lot of testing of different species of plants and which ones were able to survive winter, which ones were going to be nice thick stands so that seeds dropping into the system would not be able to germinate and come up and cause you problems. So, you know, which ones were going to be nice and prostrate, which ones, when you read the description of how the plant grows, and they say the vegetation is no more than 3 inches tall, and then you find out that no, it's more like 12. Okay, we've got all of that kind of testing has to be done as you're choosing new and different species of potential understory plants. So the ones that are listed on my website, we've tested them. And at least in those environments, they are what we want, what we expect. And then they reestablish. They all self-seed, or they have runners. They're not aggressive, so that they're not going to like sneak out and into the surrounding areas where you don't really want them going. They are easy enough to control. So choice of the right plant species. But then you're only going to plant those species in there once. They maintain themselves. Work that we've done in North and South Dakota with Jay Fuhrer and Gabe Brown. They've been working for the last 25 years on these, well, it's more like 30, on the mixtures that work for that part of the world. And so we've got 30 years of data on how beneficial it is. And it doesn't really matter what the cover crop or what the cash crop is that you're trying to grow. So they've been doing it with corn, with soybean, with wheat, so a number of different kind of main staple crops in the United States, and it works very, very well to maintain this good level of organic matter. We've seen the increases in organic matter in these fields going from less than 1% is where they started out from. So they'd been in agriculture for 40 to 50 years and absolutely obliterated the organic matter. No good yields, serious problems, massive amounts of inorganic fertilizers and pesticides going on. Started establishing these understory plants, and today we've got the organic matter in those fields in many cases up to 30%. And we have maximum yields. Usually the yields in those fields are quite a bit better than the average in the conventional agricultural fields. So the yields just skyrocket. And it's full nutrition in their soybean, which we do grade by the concentration of protein in the bean. Our growers always get maximum bonuses because their protein levels are so much higher than the conventional soybean.
Because they're accessing a more kind of holistic range of nutrients from the soil.
Yep.
As a result of that, those nutrients being made available by the microorganisms.
Exactly. Right. Precisely.
And do you have any advice for people on how they might figure out what cover crops are best to use in their area?
Typically, you want to go to a website that have the native plant species for your part of the world, and then look through that list and find the ones that the vegetation isn't more than 1 to 3 inches tall, that grow very thickly, very densely, so weeds aren't going to be able to establish within that vegetation. Ones that remain very prostrate on the surface of the soil. Ones that you can drive on. So when you are planting, you're not obliterating, what you've planted and that you want to maintain. And always plant somewhere around 20 to 25 different species of these understory plants. We don't know what the weather's going to be next spring, so we don't know which ones are going to germinate and grow come next spring. But what Gabe and Jay were seeing was that in the first year, it was these four species of plants that came up and gave them this really good cover. And then, of course, winter comes along, and they all go into dormant conditions. Now come the next spring, it's a whole set of different conditions. And so it's going to be a different set of 3 to 4 species. And the next year, it's going to be this other combination. In the whole 30 years that they've been doing this, every single seed has germinated and grown and been a portion of what is protecting that soil surface, doing the nutrient cycling, maintaining the biology in the soil. But it's never come back to exactly the same mix in any instance. So when are we finally going to have the same kind of spring so that we do see the same mix of plants? Hasn't happened yet. So will it ever happen? Has the weather ever been exactly the same in one year as it has been in another? And especially with climate change, you know. But this is the way to offset the effects of climate change, because we're protecting that soil surface. We don't have erosion. We don't have weeds. We're maintaining the biology where the plant that you want to grow, we've got the biology out there. If we need to adjust the biology at all, we may go out with some fungal foods to get a little bit more fungal. We may go out with bacterial foods if we need to make it a little bit more bacterial. So it's very easy to adjust that balance of fungi to bacteria. So it will be what the plant you're trying to grow this year actually requires. Mm.
So you're designing for a resilient system then. That's yep. One of the primary goals in that.
And the interesting part is that we don't have to rotate then. We do not rotate our cash crop.
This was going to be my next question. So this whole idea of, with sufficient soil biology, you don't have to rotate. And just see if I've kind of got this. So is the idea that even with annual crops, you don't have to rotate, because if you build up the soil biology to the stage of a sort of later succession soil, the microbiological life is so rich that you just can't deplete it at the rate at which it sustains itself, sort of faster than it would sustain itself.
So when you think about rotation, the reasons that we have to rotate in the organic world is because disease becomes overwhelming. Well, if you're not replenishing the soil biology, if that's being destroyed slowly but surely, then you don't have the protection. And now you're going to have diseases and insect pests. Mm-hmm. If you're not maintaining nutrient cycling because the biology is not being maintained, then the plant's not getting the nutrition that it requires, and so the plant's unhealthy, it's weak, it's wimpy, it's open to diseases being able to attack. Only a sick, stressed plant is putting out the verbenones, the chemical signal, that basically says to all the insect pests, come eat me, because I'm not healthy, I'm not well, I can't defend myself against you. So all the insect pests say, hey, take this guy out, because not healthy. Whereas the plant right next door that is healthy doesn't get attacked at all. And time again, we've seen the situation where, you know, we're right next to a neighboring field where clearly the plants are not getting the nutrition that they require. Whereas in our field where the plants are getting the nutrition, we have absolutely no insect pests being wiped out in that next field. So let's make sure there's no reason to have to rotate. So once you get really organic, you've got all the biology that you require. We don't need to rotate. Or maybe we need to think of it as the understory plant species are doing the rotation. They're what's coming up for the correct seasonal, weather that we're having, where that weather is selecting for these sets of species of plants. They're what coming up, that's what's rotating, and we just happen to be putting in the same cash crop year after year after year. And that's fine, because we've dealt with the fact that we're going to get rid of the insect pests, we're going to always have nutrient cycling happening properly for the cash crop that we put into the system. So are we really not rotating?
They're doing the same function, but just in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So I really want to keep testing these kinds of things. We need to have this replicated scientific studies going. It's really difficult to find money to do this sort of thing. Time and time again, we've written proposals to the USDA, and the people reviewing those proposals always say, oh, we've already investigated cover crops. There's absolutely no reason to fund this. But it's not the same cover crops, guys. One of the problems with cover crops in the conventional world, or even in the no-till world, is that we're emphasizing the wrong thing. We're emphasizing massively tall, you know, Sudan grass is a great cover crop because it grows 12 feet tall. Okay, but how are you going to get that organic matter into the soil? Because that's where we need it, not above ground. So you're going to take this 12-foot tall stand of Sudan grass, you're going to mow it down, and now you've got a layer of that cover crop sitting on the surface of the soil that's this thick. It goes anaerobic. Because as all of that decomposes so rapidly, this is just like a compost pile. And it gets really hot, it goes slimy, yucky. You can't even get your tractors into the field. You can't till your soil even if you wanted to. So how are you going to incorporate that into your soil?
And would you be getting high amounts of carbon release going off into the atmosphere in that instance, that you're not locking the carbon into the soil, it's just decomposing on the surface?
It's going anaerobic, and you know, and all kinds of other gases greenhouse gases are being produced, because only under anaerobic conditions do we take our soluble inorganic nitrogen and convert it into a gas. We're going to take our soluble inorganic nitrogen sulfur and convert it into a gas. We're going to take our phosphate, and convert it into a gas. How are you going to grow a crop in that field when all of the form of the nutrient that your plant requires is blown off into the atmosphere as a gas? Is it like, what do you, people just don't understand? Well, okay, they don't understand microbiology. So here's the information that we've got to get across to them, that going anaerobic is absolutely not acceptable if we were trying to grow crops. The only way to get a soil with a pH less than 5.5 is to have it go anaerobic. So when somebody comes and says, well, yeah, my soil is routinely at a pH of 4.5, the absolute interpretation that needs to be made at that point is their soil is anaerobic. It cannot maintain at that low a pH. And so we got a lot of mythology out there about acid soils and what's causing the acidity. And no, in every single instance, it's because something drove it anaerobic. We got compaction, water logging, puddling in the soil. We have really rapid decomposition by strictly bacteria, and that drives the anaerobic. So every single instance is actually an expression of those anaerobic conditions. So let's get structure built. Let's get oxygen into the soil. Well, how do you maintain structure? Have to have bacteria and fungi growing. Who feeds the bacteria and fungi? Exudates coming out of the root systems. So maintaining a permanent cover on that soil, but we can't have that cover growing taller than the plant we're trying to grow. So 1 to 3 inches. What if you're trying to grow microgreens? You better not have an understory plant that's getting any more than 3 inches tall, or it's going to shade your microgreen that's only getting 3 to 5 inches tall. So what crop exactly? Now, see, you could go for taller things if you're growing corn. As long as the corn can pop up and get taller than that understory plant. And so how wide is the strip that you're going to till out? So maybe with corn, where we're allowing our understory plants to be 5 inches tall, then maybe we just need a slightly wider strip so the seed will germinate and that, you know, the cotyledon and then the first true leaf is already competing with your understory plants and overshading your understory plants through that summertime period. So the competition is not strong from something that's being shaded.
Mm. Is that even in the springtime? I mean, if these plants are overwintered, or are you...
They overwinter, especially in a climate like this.
Yeah.
They overwinter because unless it freezes and kills those plants, or they're going to have to come back from seed, then they just keep growing, which is why we want to make certain that they're not going to be that tall.
Okay, but that's then the point where you need to cultivate the strip in order to provide enough space for the germination to come through without competition.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
We've got to get that seed into the ground. So we're going to be doing the strips, we're going to be doing the furrows where you're putting down those seeds.
So now I heard some current estimates of rates of soil depletion, and they're fairly horrific. Now, obviously, there's a sort of unheeded reverse trend happening, and I think when people start to understand how these things work, we can be hopeful that that reverse trend will accelerate. But just given the precarious situation, I'm wondering how you think we can proliferate this research that you're doing. I wonder whether, for example, we've been talking with the Agroecology Institute in Coventry University. I wonder whether they're hoping to look into it, or anyone else in the UK or Europe or anywhere else in the world, for that matter, if the US has proved to be somewhat resistant.
Because that conversion to understanding the biological functions in soil, that transition is happening at an ever-increasing rate. Mm. It's the International Year of the Soil. Mm. And I really think the only reason anybody is excited about soil is because we're showing that the biology in the soil does such great things. So I don't think there would have been the interest in soil if we hadn't already been working for the last 30, 35 years demonstrating that we can reverse things, and we can reverse things very rapidly if you get the right biology in the soil. So I think that's part of the excitement. We are demonstrating that despite the fact that we've taken most of our soils to less than 1%, less than 0.5% in many instances, organic matter, how rapidly can you bring that organic matter back? And it can accrue very rapidly. So, in the course of 1 year, we can go from 1% organic matter to 3% organic matter. And then the next year, we'll double it again, 6%. The next year, we'll double it again, 12%. The next year, we'll double it again, 20, 25%. And so we're going to hit a steady state somewhere here along the line, I presume, where the tillage that we are performing to put in that strip, that furrow where we're dropping in the seeds, we're going to reach a steady state, but I think it's upwards of 30% organic matter. If you go to the pioneer journals in the United States and you read the descriptions of the color of the soil, the smell of the soil, what the soil felt like, when they lift that soil up to their mouth and they take a bite of it and describe the flavor of that soil in the U.S. had a organic matter concentration of at least 30%, if not more like 60%. That's where we used to be. That's where nature had taken it to. And that's in the grasslands, the Great Plains of the United States. In the forests, we had more. And so how are we going to bring that back so we have the same kind of productivity that the pioneers described when they first broke out that soil and described the way the plants grew? They described, an agricultural heaven where they put the seeds in and they walked away from it and they didn't have to come back until they harvested. And that lasted for 15 to 25 years before they had so damaged the soil through the tillage that they were performing, that now they started to see problems. They started to see fertility problems. They started to see insect pests and diseases become a problem. And if they were able, they just let those fields go and went and farmed something else for 20, 30 years. And then they could, it's a slash and burn approach to doing agriculture. And that's fine if you've got lots of land to expand into.
And a small population to support.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's as we've grown and we've gotten too many people, and they're already taking up the land with houses, where are you going to do your agriculture? You can't move on to something else. So if we were going to maintain as we used to do, we'd have to get rid of some people. And that's probably not going to happen.
Yeah.
So now we've got to take better care of the soil. We've got to change our practices from the historic practices, but we've got to bring back, we've got to maintain that organic matter level. And I really truly believe it's got to be upwards of 30% if we're going to have the same kind of growth described in those extremely productive soils when we first broke them out of the native ecosystems. Mm-hmm. Can we do it? Sure we can. But we're going to have to think about the kinds of cover crops that we have on there, because what we're doing right now is not fixing the problem. Even at Rodale, when you look at the amount of organic matter that they've gotten into their soils, 30 years of what they're calling no-till agriculture, and they've only gotten the organic matter in the soil up to 3.5%. That's pitiful. 30 years? And they've only increased the organic matter level from 1% to 3.5%? Which, when I got there and I realized that that's what was going on, I just, what are you guys touting this no-till agriculture for? Because it's not doing the job. And then I realized they till to put in the ryegrass and the vetch, and they let that system go for about 3 months, and then they till it all up and go do something else with it. That's not no-till agriculture. 3 months no-till? I don't think that's no-till. They got to do better. So they like to call it no-till agriculture because they leave it alone for 3 months. So maybe you know why I'm not the research scientist at Rodale anymore. Because it was an impossible system to work with. They just were not interested in trying anything else. And yeah, maybe it was an interesting step along the way, but we got to do better. Got to do better.
To follow on, how do you feel people respond when you inform them of the effects of the farming practices that they have received, transmitted through their culture as the way things are done? And obviously there's been an enormous intensification of that since the Second World War, but fundamentally the practices of tillage have a very long heritage, and it strikes me that this is something that...
But tillage doesn't have that long heritage. We haven't been doing tillage as we do it now, or even since, you know, in the 1950s. So we started tilling so excessively, mm-hmm, when mechanical tractors were invented. When, thank you Australia for inventing the tractor, so that one person could go out and completely obliterate the biology in 100 acres in the course of a day. Hasn't been with us that long.
Although Mesopotamian civilizations also managed to destroy their soils with...
But it took them 500 years. Mm. It took them 1,000 years. Look at how rapidly we've destroyed the soil in the United States.
Yeah.
Ooh, 200 years. And we have pushed it into, you know, this... gosh, if we don't pay attention, human beings aren't going to be on this planet anymore. Because we have so destroyed, well, and it's really water quality that's been destroyed first. I always have to laugh when Monsanto says, oh, we've got to have genetically engineered organisms because we can't feed the world without GMOs. In 2025, we're going to run out of food to feed everybody. Guys, we're running out of water to drink right now. What's going to wipe out the human race? Lack of water. So who cares about what's going to happen in 2025? We're already in trouble, and things are getting worse. And better pay attention to keeping those nutrients in the soil where they belong, instead of letting them leach out and destroy water quality all over the planet. It's like Australia. Everybody always talks about, well, 25% of the barrier reef has been destroyed. No, it's more like 50% today. What happens to Australia when the barrier reef is completely gone? Australia is a big sandbar. What happens to the continent when it's not protected anymore? It's going to disappear back into the ocean. So, oh joy. What's going to happen to all the other places that rely on coral reefs to exist? So, need to do. do this change now. We've got to stop releasing those nutrients into letting them leach out of the soil and go into the water. So what were we talking about? I went off on this.
You did say that the escalation of agriculture has been exponential and its destructive effect.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, but you know, for me, it's the question of addressing the people's sense of farming as being something benign, and that this was something that was handed down without the sort of analytical understanding that your work brings to it. So there does seem to be a little bit of a juncture there where we now have to re-examine everything, and we can come to certain sort of uncomfortable questions about how was it that we came to this point of not perceiving that
tilling the living daylights out of soil,
that our actions were creating these problems. And I also think it's,
but go back in time.
Mm.
To, you know, like Egypt or Mesopotamia or any of the ancient cultures. And how many times a year did they till the soil? When you have to be the person out there pushing the stick through the soil, how many times a year do you till? To put the seed in. Even when you look at, you know, 1000 AD or 1700s, how many times a year did they till the soil? Once. If you've got to be behind those animals and you have to provide the power to push the plow into the soil, you only till that soil once a year to put in the seed. You might go and disturb the soil some extent if you're putting in potatoes, because you got to dig up the potatoes. But it's not the till the whole field attitude that we have. We didn't start that until we had mechanical tractors. So it's only been for the last 100 years that we've been doing that.
I mean, regardless of how young it is, it has nonetheless become deeply entrenched in our culture. So I guess the question is, how does one address that deep entrenchment in a practical way and start to undo that? So, because obviously you spent so long looking into this, and to you it's so clear, and so obviously you get frustrated when people demonstrate a lack of understanding. But how does one act with compassion for that lack of understanding in order to actually work with people to start to chip away at those presumptions?
And I think that's where we have to have demonstrations. Knowledge, the theory is clearly out there that this is the direction to go. But you have to force everybody to go this direction instantaneously. What's the transition that you offer them, where we have to be demonstrating that going in this direction is less work, you're going to make more money, you're going to keep more money in your pocket, you're not going to be giving away to chemical companies most of your earnings. So yeah, we need the demonstrations of this is working and here's how you do it. Most farmers are very interested in, okay, what's this compost tea that I'm talking about, where I end up only having to put this compost tea out 3 times, and I'm moving in this direction of healthy soil. I'm getting that biology back, and then can we explain that to maintain that biology, once it's present, you put in these understory crops.
Mm.
But we better have some good demonstrations of where it's working, because farmers are very, I want to see, I want demonstration that this is really going to work. How did you do that? What was your hookup on your tractor? You said you had a PTO. Well, exactly what was that PTO, and what's the speed that you went? What's the gear that you were using? Well, I don't have that kind of equipment. What I've got is this kind of equipment. How do I make this equipment work? And so we've got a lot of those practical, hands-on steps yet to do.
And I guess one of the tricks also as an ecologist is to sort of put aside the fact that for you it's inherently for a love of nature, but then to start actually being able to talk in agronomical terms is a very useful thing, because that's what's going to get people to adopt these practices. And whilst it might not be the kind of mindset that a lot of us come to ecology thinking through, but it's a very important thing to step into if we're really going to talk about rolling these things out in a big way.
Yep. The economics of it have to be totally transparent. We have to be able to convince people. And how can you do that unless you have demonstrations where we're keeping track of the cost of everything? And then as markets vary, and some years, you know, the price for your corn is really low, and other years it's really high, how easy is it to grow something other than corn when it's low? You know, we're going to grow barley instead because we can make some good beer out of this stuff. we could sell the beer. It's very easy when we can adjust that biology in the soil. We can grow anything from asparagus to blueberries pretty easily, pretty rapidly. We can shift from one crop to the other as markets crash and markets come back. Mm. So demonstrations. We need demos. Which is why once upon a time you had all those agricultural research centers in England, because every local area wanted the demonstrations of how to do these things right there, where they could go visit for field days and see the equipment and see how it was done and talk and chat. And now we don't have those agricultural research stations anymore. I think you've only got like Coventry has research, and Rothamsted.
And organic.
And Aberdeen. And that's Reading, I think, probably still has something.
Right.
But each county each shire does not have its own agricultural research station anymore. So how are we going to be doing the demonstrations?
Well, there was an interesting thing that came up through some of the permaculture talks at the conference, which is all about this push towards research.
Mm-hmm.
And to actually establish research centres, but also to empower citizen science. And this guy made an interesting distinction between citizen science, where you get citizens to take the data, give it to scientists, they process it, and then citizen scientists who actually have the skills and are become empowered to go out and do their own research. And as soon as you start to disseminate those skills, the research starts to proliferate in quite a big way. And I mean, it's not happening yet, but it's primed for it.
I've worked with growers throughout my career, and we'll set up experiments on their land where, you know, we've got three control areas conventional, because that's where they are coming from, and then we put up three fields where we've got the biological approach. And as soon as they see how easy it is to do agriculture in the biological fields, the next time I come back to the farm, there are no controls left. Say goodbye to I can't publish if I don't have those comparisons. And so, you know, farmers who are doing research, it's kind of dangerous.
Right.
Because as soon as they realize the benefit of just doing biological agriculture, your experiment's gone. You don't have that endpoint where you can say, here's the difference in yields. Rodale was good in that comparison. You know, if they had actually been willing to do other things.
So you intentionally malpractice in order to have a point of comparison. Mm-hmm. Whereas when you're doing it with someone who's doing it for a livelihood, then they're not. If they realize that one works, they're not going to carry on doing the other.
That's right.
I see what you mean. Yeah.
So there's an inherent danger in working with people who are out to make money, mm-hmm. and not out to do demonstrations that here's the difference between the conventional and what we want to transition to. Mm-hmm. So that's why research stations are useful, because they're the point is...
They're outside of the economic mm-hmm. impetus.
They're not trying to make money.
Yeah. Cool. Well, I had a quick question on, because we've been talking in terms of agricultural context, we were looking particularly at arable. So there's been a lot of work going into pasture as well. So Alan Savory stuff, looking at how you build soil through grazing. Looking at his systems, would you suggest any other inputs to augment that biology other than just the grazing? So would you suggest perhaps putting compost teas on grazing land as well?
To speed the process, I would definitely be out there adding a compost tea or compost extract, more likely. Compost teas are made mostly to influence the foliar part of the plant. In a pasture, we really only need to put a compost extract. So way easier to make an extract. It's a much shorter period of time. The brewing time for an extract is only half an hour to an hour, where a compost tea is 24 to 48 hours.
So this is just a liquid extract without all the bubbling, is that correct?
You're going to use the aeration to extract the organisms off the compost into the water, but then you don't add foods.
Right.
You're just going to extract.
Okay.
So generally with a compost extract, you're using more compost because you have to physically extract into the water in order to get the organisms in the water. Whereas with a tea, you're extracting from a small amount of compost, but you're multiplying those organisms by adding the food, getting them to grow.
Yeah.
But in order to get the organisms to stick to the leaf surface, you've got to have active growing organisms, making the glues that allow them to stick instantly. Of course, when you think about a leaf, the most important part of the leaf is on the bottom. And so how do you get an organism to stick to the bottom of the leaf? Because unless they're active and growing and are making the glues so they instantly stick, you know, an organism that's dormant hits the bottom of the leaf and just leaves with the water, and you don't get the benefit from it. So compost extract into the soil, because as those organisms move with the water, they're going to hold up on the surfaces of the organic matter, on the positively and negatively charged sand, silt, and clay particles, organic matter in that soil.
So yeah, this is your sort of toolkit. If we're talking about sort of biology-directed soil management, would it be the actual mother material, as I might call it, of from which you make the compost tea? If you want to direct things in a more fungal direction, you would have had a compost that's more woody versus vice versa. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's where these recipes come in. What kind of biology do you want to enhance and encourage?
Yeah.
So you've got to go back to your soil and look at what's in your soil, what's lacking. And therefore I want to design my compost recipe so we'll grow the organisms that are lacking in my soil.
And this is where you brought up the microscopes that you recommend, and you have a course in identification. So could you say a bit about that and how people have found that helpful in their soil management?
Yeah, people are enjoying the course a great deal because they can take it, because it's online, they can do the course when they have time instead of, you know, like at university or something, you've got to be there Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then the practical, the laboratory is on Thursday and Friday, and if you don't show up at the right time, it's like, well, not my fault. It's your problem. You can, because it's online, you can go at your own pace. And so we go through how do you use the microscope, and, you know, it's like every time somebody kind of, they take part of, they start working on part of the course, and then they get really busy for 4 or 5 weeks, and then they come back to it. If it was a normal course, you'd be kind of lost. And with the online course, you can always go, what am I supposed to do? I can go back and I can rewatch those segments that were, okay, now this is how I do the condenser.
Yeah.
Here's what I have to do to shadow. Here's what I...
The bit where you've fallen asleep during the class and you can just rewind it and start again. Yeah.
And when the phone rings and you've got to go answer it, you can rewind and get back to what you missed. And we just go through the identifications of all of the organisms.
So you made it sound
really
very
like
exciting
it.
Looking at them. I really want to get my hands on these things and just start. I think it's in the Symphony of the Soil film, you describe it as it looks like Times Square all the time. Times Square on New Year's Eve all the time.
Right, yep.
Yeah,
yep.
Sounds great.
Everything just moving and going and zooming. So when you get your soil into that condition, it's just so gratifying to see it. Because probably what's happened is, you know, they'll take a look at their soil to begin with and it's like, there's nobody here. There's nothing in this soil but some little bacteria sitting there just kind of jiggling at me. No one else is home. Yep. Things are bad. So what are you going to do to get that biology back in there? And then they can be watching their own compost too. Because, you know, okay, I did this recipe. What are the organisms that have grown up in the first 24 hours? Well, who's still there 48 hours? What happens after 7 days? What does it look like after 14 days? And so it's gratifying to see the biology increase and grow, and you see all the good guys coming along. Or you take a look and you go, why are all these ciliates here? No, I messed up. But you know instantly that something's wrong. And typically if you're looking at your compost, especially as it's going along, and you start to see ciliates increase, you start to see no more fungal hyphae, you can fix the problem before everything is just really like, well, give it up, throw it away, start over. Yeah. You can fix it long before it becomes at that point where it's not worth it. And you wasted all that time.
So another thing I've heard you mention in other interviews is being able to halt erosion in a very short space of time. And so, correct me if any of the assumptions I'm making here are wrong. I would assume that the erosion is occurring in a place that's both deprived of organic matter and of soil life.
Mostly soil life, because we've worked with situations where there's plenty of organic matter in that soil, but because of management practices that they've performed, the biology has been obliterated. And so there's nothing to hold either the organic matter or the soil mineral particles in place. And they move with the water as it's moving down the hill.
Because what I wanted to establish was, is it all that you have to do is to simply inoculate the full spectrum of the food web? And as long as there's some plants growing there, they will provide the food for those organisms. And then there'll be a sort of positive feedback loop where both start to improve their vitality. Is you're not coming on with a bucket load of compost to feed those organisms. It's just the inoculation?
It depends on how fast you want to shut the erosion down.
Okay.
And what's the condition of that soil that's happily moving with the water as it's going down the hill. Mm. If you've actually got some life in that soil, and all we really need to do is get them to wake up and start doing their job of gluing everything together, binding everything together. Sometimes all we have to do is add the foods. Wake them up, get going, things. We don't even have to have plants.
And then so even in a really short period, they can form that structure that's required to hold the water and prevent the runoff.
Yep, and so Hendrika Schraven and I we're the two people that have done most of that work, and you know he's continuing to do more and more demonstration all over the place. He shuts down erosion within 24 hours, overnight. You can have that mass starting to move. You come in and apply both the organisms usually and the foods, because you know what's really missing, especially when you have a client that calls up and says, it's starting to go. What are you talking about? You know, well, here's my situation. Here's what's happening. Can you come out and can you shut this down? And it's like, it better be shut down today.
The emergency services of agroecology.
Yeah.
So your process is go to the place, look at it in the microscope. That tells you what you need to do.
Mm-hmm. But sometimes you're in the triage stage and you don't have time to check and see what's there. So we're just going to put it all out there, all at the same time. So it's going to be compost tea with lots of extra foods for everything. And that always works, but it's the most expensive. If we have the time to go out and look at what's there so we can make just what's necessary, then it typically is less expensive. You know, it's the difference between 30 cents an acre and $100 an acre. And sometimes when you're looking at the lawsuit because your soil, your cliff, your steep slope is about to wipe out somebody's house at the bottom of the slope, who cares what price? Because $100 an acre, unimportant when you're looking at $1 million lawsuit. So sometimes it is that extreme. Most of the time it isn't. So...
Mm-hmm.
And so we've talked a lot about soil biology in terms of fertility, and I know we touched a little bit on carbon, but yeah, can you go a little bit further into this, because there's something that's really big at the moment. There's a lot of buzz in the air about the potential for soil carbon sequestration. Most notably, Alan Savory is making really sort of large claims about what his methods can do. And so what's your take on the potential for sequestering post-industrial carbon?
And there's a huge potential there. What some people who aren't microbiologists kind of get stuck on is the fact that microorganisms are going to decompose these plant materials. And, there's going to be CO2 released because these microorganisms are going to decompose these materials. And so it's bad that these microorganisms are decomposing these plant materials. Well, there is no way in God's green earth that those materials are not going to be decomposed. It's carbon. Some microorganism is going to grow on it and lets us process, make certain that that process is going to maximize the amount of carbon that's going to be turned into organic matter and the least amount of CO2 that's going to be blown off into the atmosphere. And so we really want to promote fungal biomass doing that decomposition, because fungi, when they utilize carbon substrates, are only going to blow off about 20% of that carbon as CO2. 80% remains in the soil in the form of the carbon pipe or the metabolites that the fungi use, the waste compounds that they poop out, if you will, and structurally very complex, very long half-life carbon substrates that they're putting into the soil. There's been a lot of errors that people have done when they've been looking at fungi, because often they will only look at the respiring portion of the fungal hyphae.
Yeah, imagine.
And that's only the tip. Now that little fungus is leaving a football field's worth of hyphae behind it, which is almost pure carbon.
And that's sequestered in the soil, right?
Yep, and it's got a half-life of, a couple hundred years.
And that's on the respiring fungi.
Because it's only the tip where it's growing. It grows from the tip. So if what you're using is as a determinant of how much fungal hyphae do you have in the soil, you're using respiration as that indicator, you are going to massively underestimate how much carbon is now left in that soil. So they've used just idiotic measurements because they clearly have no idea the difference between how bacteria grow and how fungi grow. So, the studies that are done are just absolutely misinformation in many instances because they don't understand the difference between fungi and bacteria. When you look at that fungal tip cell, it has the same carbon and nitrogen ratio as a bacterium. But as you move further back, the fungus puts down layers, massive layers, of basically pure carbon organic matter to solidify, and it's almost like a storage form. If that fungus decides that there's not enough food going this way, it's going to take that cytoplasm and turn around and come back through the hypha and start another branch going out a different way looking for food. And it just means we're sequestering more and more and more carbon. But you have to use the right methods to assess what's the carbon that's been left behind in that carbon pipe.
Yeah.
Don't ignore it.
And you say it's the approach is about maximizing the amount of carbon that's held in the soil, minimizing the amount that's given off. What do you think of the use of biochar as an aggregate, as something which halts that process of decomposition?
You're not going to halt the process of decomposition when you put biochar in the soil, because the microorganisms, especially fungi, they're going to use the biochar. It's a carbon source, and so there is going to be a decomposition process. It's not like biochar is permanently and forever sequestered.
But, there are stories of in the Amazonian Terra Preta finding sort of digested fish bones that have been there for like hundreds and hundreds, possibly even thousands of years. My sort of layman's reading of that is that it's slowing down that process.
And if you really want to slow down and not have any decomposition at all, let it go anaerobic and produce an extremely acidic condition,
right.
But you can't grow plants in it. And that's what they haven't recognized with the Terra Preta, some of those deposits that they're talking about, where it's basically preserved through the acids that have been produced under the anaerobic conditions.
Some of the Terra Preta isn't actually as fertile as we might think.
Absolutely. The people who went and wrote those stories about Terra Preta and how this were, the Mayans were composting and this is how, what, they have no idea. It was a made up story because they don't know what the Mayans were doing with or without that material. So is it really from a long ago burn? They were doing slash and burn agriculture through much of what we know of the Mayan culture. They were doing slash and burn. And so that Terra Preta is really the charcoal that was left over when they burned the jungle, and you have that burnt layer that appears in the soil. And yep, over time, as water moves through it, the humic acid is, some of it's soluble, and you're moving that soluble humic acid down.
So it could well have been a completely unintentional...
I suspect a great deal of that was completely unintentional. Now, when I use biochar, what I want to do is actually inoculate organisms into the biochar.
Mm. Right.
So that all of those, if you've ever looked at wood as it's been turned into charcoal, which is really about what biochar is.
Yes.
It's charcoal. There's a lot of condominium housing.
The surface area is massively increased.
Right. Yeah. And so you have all these wonderful little apartments in there that are highly protected. Great places for all these different organisms to get in, and their predators can't get to them.
Right.
And so it's like mom and dad have settled down in this apartment complex, and they're producing babes. And every time, it gets a little overcrowded in there, mom and dad say, "Go west, young man. Exit. Go find your..." And so they move out into the soil. So there's this constant inoculation, this really good set of microorganisms, this massive diversity that's living in the biochar.
So you're using biochar as habitat, and that not so much to slow down the process of decomposition, and then the fungi that move into those apartments, as it were, then they're doing the sequestration. They're creating these networks of sequestered carbon.
Yep, and the biochar is a lot less rapid in its decomposition. Well, it's not. There's an interesting thought. How much slower is the decomposition of biochar as compared to the wood? That the wood chunk that, before it was carbonized, before it was crystallized structure, how much slower is the decomposition? And I'm not sure that they've really looked at that. We're making stories about how slow biochar is decomposing.
And so it's more to do with the fact that, say, in Terra Preta, it achieved an anaerobic state. That's why it didn't decompose, rather than biochar has these sort of innate resistance to decomposition.
Well, especially when you're looking at fish bones that are left over. The only reason that fish bone isn't decomposing is because it's got to be preserved in some way or another. The actual decomposition has been shut down. Biochar and by itself, if you're just adding that biochar into the soil, structurally, it's going to give you fluff. There's going to be better air movement into that area because the biochar is a lot like vermiculite or perlite or zeolite. It gives you physical structure, allowing better movement of oxygen and water and your roots into that soil. And in some of the studies that have been done, I think that's the explanation for the improved plant growth, is because here's their control where they're doing the conventional agricultural thing, and over here they've now tilled the biochar into the soil. You've fluffed the soil, and you've left behind something that gives you physical structure, so oxygen, water, and roots will be able to grow deeper. And so, of course, these plants grow better. And really the only explanation is that over here we had deeper root systems than in the conventional system where the compaction is right there at the surface of the soil. If you're going to till over here, you have to till over here. Otherwise, it's not a fair comparison.
Right, right. So see, a friend of ours has a theory about biochar. He suspects that it neutralizes our strategic bacteria, and that's possibly why you find a reduced rate.
Strategic?
So apparently in nature, there are these two strategies for reproduction. R, which I assume stands for rapid rate or something like that, and then K, strategic. So R, strategic being...
R and K selected. It's just I've never heard that.
Right, yeah, so the bacteria that just reproduce at a rapid rate and therefore are emitting lots of CO2. He has a suspicion that that the biochar actually neutralizes...
They don't. Doesn't neutralize it, sorry. But it's not a food resource. Mm. Because the C-N ratio, you know, bacteria have to have a really high level of nitrogen, soluble, available nitrogen for them to be able to grow. Mm-hmm. So really rapid growth by bacteria requires a lot of all of the nutrients being available within the range of that bacterium. Well, with that biochar, there aren't any soluble available.
So it's not that the biochar neutralizes, it's just it doesn't provide what it needs.
Right.
Right. Yeah, that was interesting because he had this sort of suspicion. He was like, I want someone to test it for me, but no one told him he didn't try.
Yep, we basically already know that.
Right.
So biochar is not a food resource for bacteria, it's strictly only a food resource for fungi, which is, here's another potential positive. But you have to inoculate the fungi because most of our agricultural soils have no fungi left in them. And that's always one of those things when people start using a microscope and they say, I searched, I looked through 1,000 fields and there were no fungi in there. Well, I think you could have stopped after 20 fields. There are no fungi present in 20 fields. You're not going to find them in 1,000 fields. So start getting those fungi back into the system. We've just really done a fantastic job of wiping out that fungal community and the protozoa and the good guy nematodes and the microarthropods and the, yeah. So we've left most of our agricultural soils are strictly bacterial, nothing else. Well, not going to benefit your plant much.
So I just want to test how far are we into this? I've got a couple of points that I couldn't resist, but if you're very tired, it's fine to stop at this point.
No, that's fine. Let's go on. This is my favorite topic to talk about. Yeah, I could go on probably all night. So I wouldn't do so well at my conference tomorrow, but so probably not too much longer.
Certainly. All right. As we bring things to a close then, there's a couple of other sort of branches of all this alternative agriculture that I want to see how your understanding makes clearer, possibly. The first of which is something called bokashi. Now, my understanding of bokashi is that it's able to create a non-toxic product in anaerobic conditions, a decomposition. So people have food waste, which typically would be quite high in nitrogen. It's also used for human waste in composting toilet systems. I'd heard you speak of anaerobic organisms as being pretty much universally harmful. And I don't really claim to understand what the bokashi process is, but it seems to be somewhat akin to lactic acid fermentations, pickling, in other words. So I struggle to understand how this fits into the picture.
Well, yeah, Dr. Higa in Japan noticed that when people took bokashi that had been made, which is And there are a number of different ways to make bokashi, and there's where some of the confusion comes from. Whereas it started in Japan, at Korea, in Southeast Asia, most of those cultures have their version. Well, in the West, we have this a version of bokashi. We call it sauerkraut.
Yeah.
So you're going to take cabbage, and you're going to, sometimes people chop it up, and some people just put the whole head in there, yeah, whatever. But you're going to put it in with a liquid, salt water, basically, yes, is what you've made. Yes. And now you're going to put the lid on the pot and seal it up and stick it in your soil and let it ferment for 9 months or whatever it is. And it's going to go through a really stinky, smelly stage,
yeah,
where a lot of that organic, the soluble nutrients are going to be released in some really wonderful, smelly,
yeah,
sulfur, conditions.
Yeah.
Yep. So the hydrogen sulfide is, or the SO4 is converted into H2S, which mm-hmm. has a rotten egg smell to it. Mix that with a little ammonia, and mix it with a little vomit, a little, you know.
Nappies.
Yeah. Let's describe, how do you describe that? How do you distinguish rotten egg from rotten egg with ammonia? Or rotten egg with vomit smell? It stinks.
Poetry of composting.
Yeah. I was threatening people, I'm going to get little vials, and I'm going to, you know, collect those gases at some composting operation, and then keep them, and then when I talk about compost, I'm going to open up the vial and go, see, that's this smell, as people, you know, throw up in the back.
As a compost artist, do you develop a sort of weird sort of taste for these things, and weird appreciation for the kind of the plethora of smells you get out?
Yep. And what I keep struggling with is, how do you describe, what are the words you use? Because what I've seen is, like, if I'm talking about, you know, a locker room dirty sock smell, everybody has their slightly different version of exactly what that is. So, okay, that's not going to work. So I think the only way to do it is hands-on, make some compost. And some of your compost piles are going to be failures, and you're going to learn what these woo smells are. Mm. And when I did this, here's the smell that came out. But you can't describe it to anybody. We don't have that language. The precision isn't there. So everybody has to make their own compost. That's all there is to it. And see, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, when you were the youngest in the family, you were the one that got to deal with the compost pile. You got to take all that waste material out to the compost pile in the backyard someplace, and you became the manager of the compost pile. That was typical in most people's families. It's just that very few people wrote about it, because everybody did it. Everybody compared notes on what the smell was, and what happened to that compost pile burst into flames. So you didn't have to write about it. But you, like Mendel's notebooks, he describes his process of making compost. He describes his process of making compost tea. That's how they grew plants throughout the Middle Ages. The very first manual on how to do agriculture describes how to make compost and how to make compost tea. 300 BC, first manual ever written in the Roman Empire on how to do agriculture. And the way they did it was to make compost and compost tea, put the biology out there. They didn't know that's what they're doing. But Bokashi, back to the subject at hand, the organisms that are doing that decomposition of the cabbage and turning it into the finished product, which to me is completely and totally inedible.
Yeah. I make sauerkraut.
See, excellent sauerkraut. You might win you over.
Kimchi is good.
Oh no.
Interesting.
But see, I wasn't brought up with it.
No.
I was never. It wasn't probably until I was 17, 18 years old that somebody really introduced me to sauerkraut. And by that time, it's like, no, not gonna cross my lips. And it's, you know, it's like with durian. Have you ever had durian?
No.
It's a tropical fruit that's called the king of fruit, because the people who have a taste for it, it's like eating marzipan or something to them. They just, oh man, it's the most wonderful. I can't get this stuff to my mouth because of the smell.
No, I think there's an ancestral element to this too. I'm part Polish, and you know, the sort of Anglos haven't gone near sauerkraut for a long time. So.
Yeah, but they make leek soup. So, Every culture has their... Yeah. You have to be raised...
As an adopted Welshman, I'm really getting a taste for leek soup.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Serious, I'm not really
and
sure.
And lava bread, seaweed. Oh, Lord.
So this bokashi is proving elusive.
I keep getting distracted by other things. So in that process, the organisms that are going to grow in those conditions are some pretty consistently present. Mm-hmm. There's always going to be lactobacillus. Mm-hmm. And typically around 8 to 12 different species, depending on what was on the surface of the of the cabbage when you put it in there. There is always lactobacillus growing on the surface of a cabbage, as long as you haven't fumigated it.
Yeah.
They're going to be present. Lactobacillus is going to produce a whole lot of acid.
Yeah.
They're going to drop the pH down to around 4, typically.
Mm-hmm.
It's a balance of a number of different processes going on, a number of different organic acids being produced, but they are going to be dropping the pH down really low. That, if you had any roots in that material, would kill the roots. Yeah. It's just... No, but they don't produce hydrogen sulfide, they don't produce ammonia, they don't cause the loss of most of your major soluble nutrients.
Okay.
They don't have that ability. So they're not producing the horrible stinky smells either. They don't release those nutrients in those forms. So if you have those bacteria, you could put them into a manure pile and shut down the production of the stinks and the bad smells, but your pH is going to go way low. So if your problem is that the EPA is going to come shut you down because of the odors that are being produced, you can use those lactobacillus to cut the smell. So fine, but it doesn't make good compost.
It's really just addressing symptoms.
Particular things that are causing you problems. So, great. Now, also in bokashi or kimchi or sauerkraut, you're typically going to find a whole bunch of different kinds of yeasts. Which, okay, they're producing some stinky, smelly stuff. What's your balance of yeast to lactobacillus? Typically, Dr. Hika, for example, showed there were a number of pseudomonads that occur in these, you know, facultative anaerobes. Pseudomonads, and they break down a lot of toxic materials. If you were growing your cabbage in a soil that contained a lot of lead or a lot of mercury, those lactobacillus are going to take those heavy metals and put them into the structure of the organic matter, where it's going to be something that just passes right through your digestive system and doesn't kill you as a result. So positives, negatives, a lot of acid being produced.
So it can have some applications, some specific applications, but it doesn't buck the trend in any way of what
it's not really going to give us good plant production.
Yeah.
If that's the only biology that you're putting into your soil, you're dealing with a soil that's been fumigated, that's been completely wiped out, it's not going to give you good growth. It might shut down some smells, but what Dr. Higa noticed was that when he took the liqueur from bokashi and he threw it onto the soil, that the disease causing the clubroot on the cauliflower was ameliorated. That liqueur killed off those bacteria causing clubroot and killing the cauliflower. Okay, great. If you've got clubroot, use that kind of... you know, low acid or acid conditions, and it shuts down those bacteria. But then,
why do you have a clubroot?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and might there be an easier, less problematical way to deal with a clubroot? Just make sure that you actually have the biology in your soil to begin with, that you don't have to go through the decrease in production of your cauliflower.
Yeah.
So, okay. If you have nothing else, then that liqueur does a good job. But it's not, Mother Nature is telling you, you don't have the biology in your soil, and you have not fixed the problem by putting on bokashi or kimchi or whatever.
Well, thank you, that's very clear. So this will be my final one.
It's the
Yeah, just one little tiny subject.
This is what people are going to be really sort of eager to hear your take on. It's slightly left field. But.
Well, yeah, I mean, so obviously there are parallels between what you talk about, especially with compost teas and Steiner's recommendations to put a cow horn in the ground from equinox to equinox and...
You're going to take a cow horn and you're going to fill it up with manure.
Exactly. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. And then stirring it for exactly 60 minutes, creating vortices, and yeah, spraying that out onto your farmland.
If you have really...
That's a particular time of day.
The particular time of day, I have absolutely no data corroborating
okay.
that.
Okay.
And we've
have
tried.
Have you done tests into it?
Yes, we've tested it, and you know if the time of day really makes a difference, we should be able to detect it in the biology. No, absolutely not possible. So I have a but it's not Steiner that was making those kinds of statements. It's Maria Thun that was doing all of the calendar stuff and the time of day and the day of the week and, you know, this is a growth day, this is a resting day.
Although generally,
Steiner.
So what was he saying?
He recommended to do the horn manure in the afternoons, generally speaking. That's my understanding. And I think that comes from Steiner.
Yeah, I don't remember the afternoon part, but
That aside, what have you found looking at the bidonite preparations, and also if you looked at any of the compost preparations, because they're also very specific, and I'm curious what your research into them has shown.
When you take a cow horn, and one of the things I'm not really sure about, I don't see a lot of data corroborating is that it has to be a lactating female cow horn, not a steer horn. No, it doesn't work.
Yes.
I haven't seen any difference.
Okay.
So I'm not quite sure.
And you've actually tested with different ones.
Yeah.
So you've really, really gone to town on putting it to the scientific grill then.
Yep. And one of the things Steiner talked about is, you know, the pit has to be in a certain location, and when you pack the cow horns in there with completely filled, and you have to stuff the manure.
Yes.
You don't just like kind of, you know, little balls in there.
Yeah,
you pack it in.
Or use spoons.
And you press down on it, and I'm sure Pfeiffer would have had some things to say about exactly how much you pack it, but I haven't been able to get hold of his notebooks and read his notebooks. So, you know, you layer the cow horns in, and then you fill the pit up, you cover everything up with the soil. Mm-hmm. Well, all of that soil moving down through those cow horns are inoculating the manure.
Mm-hmm.
And so all these, the earthworms are coming in because that manure is a great source of food for the earthworms. And here's the microarthropods coming in. And so all of the organisms in that soil are getting inoculated into the manure inside the horns. The horns, in my opinion, because it's an opinion, I don't have the data to document that these organisms are extracting the calcium, the nutrients out of that cow horn and moving it into the manure, and we're elevating the nutritional concentration of that manure. Also, you know, I've had some arguments about this with various biodynamic people, but what I read and what I remember reading in Steiner's book, Agriculture, is that you're supposed to have water dripping on the surface so that all of the horns stay moist. You don't just make a pit and leave it. You've got to make certain moisture is being maintained
moist
in that pit.
Moist, but not anaerobic.
Moist, but not waterlogged.
Because I've seen failed horn manures that have come out stinking.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't exactly clear to me what had brought that about.
And if it's getting too wet, they're not aware of the hydrology of their soil, and that they dug this pit, and now it's basically a well. and this is filling up with water. What if the bottom of that pit is now so completely compacted because you dug it, the pit in a place where you compacted the bottom when you did it, or it was already compacted and water just filled it all up? Well, it's going to be complete and total bust. Because if you do it properly, that horn manure has been converted into compost and some really excellent compost. Mm-hmm. If you really follow Steiner's recommendations on doing this, amazing stuff. And fungal like you would not believe.
So if you follow the recommendations he lays out in his book,
mm-hmm.
and ignore a lot of the sort of superstructural stuff that's been tagged on sort of after its publication.
Yep. And if you go back to the Bible and read what he says in there, as long as you're aware of, you know, problems with overwatering or underwatering, that's the horn manure comes out just amazing.
How do you think he figured that out? Because he had no sort of actual practical background.
Well, but he had Ehrenfeld Pfeiffer working with him. And Ehrenfeld was a microbiologist and really knew his stuff.
So we should perhaps be calling them Pfeiffer preparations.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and it's always interesting to me that there are five different traditions in biodynamics. There are five different groups that, and you'll find them in various places around the world. And like the one of the groups in the United States, they absolutely say there are only five preparations. That's it. Steiner didn't talk about anything more in his book. Only five preps. Go to the second group of biodynamic people in the United States, and they talk about 25 different preparations. Go to the biodynamic group in Brisbane, in Australia. They've got 250 preps. So, who's right? Who's really following the Steiner tradition? Which is the real biodynamics? Would you please stand up? And I had a class once where two of the heads of the five different traditions were in my class, and they were in the same class together. And they would yell. They started, you know, they would argue with each other in the class.
This is unfortunate,
Mm-hmm. It's just, okay, I'm a little confused about exactly what's the real biodynamics.
Yeah, sure.
Because there's a lot more writings by Steiner and Pfeiffer than in the one book that Steiner wrote, Agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the European work that was done by Pfeiffer, his notebooks are in the possession of this Lübke family. And if you want to read Pfeiffer's notebooks, the work he was doing with Steiner, the research he was doing together, the notebooks are with the Lübkes. If you want to find out what Pfeiffer did when he came to the United States and worked for, I think it was like the last 30 years of his life, where it was in upstate New York, those notebooks are at the Pfeiffer Center in upstate New York. They will not let you read them. I can't even get my hands on them because the person who's in charge of them doesn't want anybody to touch them. Wow. Very frustrating, because I think there's a lot of research that was done there. Why have to reinvent the wheel? Why do we have to go back and redo stuff when Pfeiffer didn't? Mm. And the information's in his notebooks.
Why do you think it is that these people are so concerned that it stays hidden? Do you think perhaps they feel that it sort of contrasts or conflicts with some of the other stuff that was written and perhaps debunks some of it?
I'm afraid so. I'm afraid that's why they're afraid. Mm. And so, or they're afraid that somebody who isn't going to be honest about the translation, because a lot of what Pfeiffer wrote was in Austrian or German, and so you've got to have somebody who can read and interpret. I'm not so good at it. And all of the Pfeiffer journals that are in Austria are all in Austrian, and I don't read that very well. It takes me, you know, 24 hours to interpret one page, just because I got to kind of keep looking up, you know, get the dictionary out and try to figure out what he was actually trying to say.
Yeah.
My Austrian isn't that good. My German is a little bit better, but not that much. Mm. So you need an interpreter. So here we are with all of these different preparations. I worked with the Josephine Porter Institute for a while, and the first person they had making the preps, those preparations were amazing because they were so fungal. They had really good protozoa in them. They had really good nematodes present in them. So, wow, yeah, biodynamic works, absolutely. If that one person had been able to train the person who followed, or the person who followed them had actually paid attention to what Helen was doing, I think we'd have a lot different attitude about biodynamics. But once Helen retired, the person who took over from her was clueless. Those preparations are not worth anything. They're garbage. They are not done properly. So what was different about what Helen was doing and what the current person, whose name I can't even remember because they so annoyed me. Because it was just like, nobody's getting good results with them anymore.
So the compost preps equally, when they're well made, they're equally high fungal inoculants for the, right? And then what about the stirring? Because that sounds to me like that's equivalent to a compost extract.
Yeah, it's aeration. But you know, I get really tired going, you know, this way for 5 minutes and then that way for 5 minutes. I have so many other things to do in my life than sit there and stir pots. I'm going to get an aeration. I'm going to
So you're bubbling. The Australians created stirring machines to do it. did you look at how they compared?
No, I haven't.
Would you still always favor a bubbler?
I don't think it probably makes a difference.
As long as for the aeration.
Yeah, whether you've got a bunch of, you know, arms going around, and I've seen some of them where they have, you know, kind of these paddle-shaped pumps, and this one goes around over here, and this one goes around, and ooh, this is kind of cool, the way they intermix, way that mixing, I don't think it makes a lot of difference.
Sure.
Typically with those stirrers, they're not going fast enough to really cause slicing and dicing and crushing of the organisms.
Right.
You know, aeration with an air pump, as long as you're not blasting the water out of the tank, you can't aerate fast enough to really harm the organisms in there.
Yeah.
So, putting things through sieves, really bad idea. Because you will absolutely destroy the fungi.
Right, of course, the shreds.
Yep. Think about yourself on it. You know, sit up against a sieve and all that water pushing, that pressure, just destroys them.
So, on a closing note, perhaps we'll end with the same question we asked Patrick. So, there are a number of different dimensions to ecological work. There's the heart work of the actual physical restoration of systems. Then there's the more sort of personal or spiritual side, whereby this very intimate relationship with the natural world can sort of make you reflect upon yourself and reconsider your role within the world and your identity. So you say a few words perhaps on how your work has affected the way you see yourself in the world. Has it affected those sort of things?
I don't see how you could not be affected. The work that you're doing is you're sitting and, you know, preparing soil samples, and you've got to sit here for 5 minutes and shake. What's going to be going through your mind? What are you thinking about? And you know, what am I really doing when I'm shaking? Am I really dispersing? What's the effect on the microorganisms? And then you take a look at what's present. We've done the experiments where we've only shaken for 10 seconds, for 20 seconds, for 30, 50, and what's the effect of the shaking on the organisms. We've gone for where we get maximum counts. But you spend a lot of time thinking when you're doing kind of dull, boring tasks. Mm. I, as I'm going through microscope slides, I'm looking at 20 fields on each of the microscope slides, I tend to sing to myself, you know. So we invent nematode songs, we have bacteria songs, we've got five different song books.
Could you perhaps share with us one of your favorite of these songs?
Oh gosh, it's been a while. Well, it's just after Christmas, so we've gone through all the Christmas nematode songs. So I'm dreaming of a white nematode, just like the ones I saw before. So, we get pretty silly in the laboratory when we're doing some of this, because we're all kind of, come on, where's the fungus? Where, oh, where has my fungus gone? Where, oh, where can it be? With two branches and four branches and nine branches on the first day of Christmas, my true love sent to me a nematode. You know, so six golden nematodes, four calling fungi, three. So we get pretty silly.
Fantastic.
Yeah, you have to have a sense of humor when you're doing things in that can be pretty routine. And so the way you keep yourself awake, the way is to have those interactions with other people in the lab.
And I guess also there must be some, even though it gets very routine, there must be some element of where when you first look through that microscope and you see this world of life there, and you just suddenly become shocked into an awareness of quite how complex and beautiful and kind of completely unknown the sort of and how mysterious the natural world is. That must be quite. Does it, even within the kind of drudgery of the routine, does it occasionally pop back as in that same striking way?
Yep. So when you've been working really hard to try to bring the biology along and get it up, and now you're going to actually take a look after two weeks after you did something that you're like, oh, please, please let it work. Let my understanding of life and biology and please let it have worked. And so you're just in total trepidation. The drop goes on the slide, the cover slip, and you put it on the microscope, you turn the light on, and it's just like, oh, please, God. And you look through there, and it's like Times Square on New Year's Eve, and just, oh, yes, this is pretty. take a look, you've got to look at this, we got to film this, we got to have a video. And it's just, you know, that feeling of success, we've done it, we really do know what we're doing. And then, you know, when somebody sends the sample in, it's like, oh, I know this soil's not any good. I know this is not soil, this is dirt. But maybe I'm wrong. So you're kind of hoping that there's going to be something, and you take a look through the microscope, and you just kind of go, you know, their compost is garbage. This isn't garbage. This isn't good stuff. This is, you know, that just that sinking feeling that you get when it's like, there's no life. There aren't even bacteria in here. So we've got so much work to do to bring this back to a condition where the plants are going to be healthy again. So, yeah, there's, you know, where does the esoteric stop and start, where does the science, where we're just being absolutely factual? It's really hard to do, and I don't want to split it. I don't want to dehumanize what I'm doing. I want those feelings of success and the feelings of, okay, it's really bad. It's really, really bad. So let's not.
Because I guess that intensity of feeling or emotion when you encounter dirt, you encounter dead soil, that's what keeps you going in some ways, it must. I imagine that would have been.
And as we watch that soil, the dirt turn back into soil, and just that joy that we've done the right thing here, and yes, the plants are growing better, and the reason they're growing better is here's the proper balance. Mm. And every time, you know, we still discover stuff in soil. You know, when all of a sudden you have some nematode trapping fungi in there, and it's like, wow, look at this, it's just beautiful. There's still stuff in soil, I don't know what it is, and I don't think we'll ever have that, or I won't ever have that completely known. There's always, you know, Mother Nature always throws something else at you, that, what the heck is this? It's like when I first moved to Oregon, having worked in the Great Plains of the United States, worked up in lodgepole pine forests, went to Oregon and looking through some soils, it was really late at night. And the next field I looked at, here's this round, clear kind of structure. It's got two dark ears on the top, two little eyes, nose, smiling mouth. And I'm just like, it's 2 a.m. in the morning. It's perhaps time to go home and go to bed. Because I'm seeing Mickey Mouse in my field of view. And I just kind of closed everything down and just went home. And it's the next morning, coming in and I'm going, I was really tired. Okay, I didn't really see that. I was hallucinating. I've been staring at too many soil samples. And so all through, while I'm doing the samples through the morning, it's like, am I going to see Mickey Mouse again? Am I going to see him again? So after lunch, look, and I'm starting to feel like, okay, I just was really hallucinating last night because I haven't seen him. And so like 1:30 in the afternoon, there he is again. Oh my God. And I say, gosh, who was the technician at the time? Come over here, take a look and tell me what you see in here. And so he looks through the microscope and he starts laughing and he says, Elaine, how can you get a Mickey Mouse face that small? You have to have put that in the sample. So how do you get micro-sized Mickey Mouse faces? And I'm like, no, John, no. I'm really, you see it? Yeah, there's a Mickey Mouse face in there. Oh, good, I'm not crazy. And then it's, have you ever seen anything like this? And we started dragging everybody in the department. Come in here, tell us what you see, tell us what this is. They were all having the same kind of reaction. How did you get micro-sized Mickey Mouse faces in here? No, really, this is in our samples. Well, you're crazy. You just, you're trying to pull my leg. And so people stopped walking past my lab because we would keep dragging them in there and saying, do you have any idea what this is? The world's expert on the genetics of conifers was in the next lab down. And so Stephen Strauss, we had him come in and look at it, and he goes, not a clue, Elaine, would you stop fooling around? This is not funny at all. I was like, no, really, what is this? And so finally Nan Vance comes back from 6 months down in the Antarctic, and of course we grab her as soon as she walks by. Come in here, I bet you cannot tell us what this is. And we're all kind of, yeah, we've got something that we're stumping everybody on the planet. Nobody knows what this is. Nan sits down and she says, Elaine, that's conifer pollen. That is how the genetics, that's how the DNA of conifers get moved around. The world's expert on the genetics of conifers had no clue of how the DNA moves around. And I just like, okay, these GMO guys, these genetic engineers, clueless when it comes to actual biology. They are, they don't know what the structure is that the pollen moves, the genetic material moves around. So it was an eye opener. Yeah.
And that itself is slightly worrying.
Yeah, that there's such a dichotomy between people who work at this level of resolution and they have no idea of, exactly how these things are.
What's going on beneath the surface.
Yeah. So it's a little scary. So there's still stuff. I have no idea what it is.
Well, good. We need to keep on going.
That's right.
Stuff to do.
Yep. And we need lots more help doing it too. But there is a growing demand for people who are trained in this to help growers all over the world figure out how to go through this transition in the most effective, least expensive, most rapid way to achieve the right kind of biology in the soil so they can get off the toxic chemicals. I don't think there's a farmer out there who really likes applying all of those toxic chemicals in the inorganic fertilizers. They can see the damage that it does. They just don't know how to farm without using those things. they want to know for absolute sure they're going to be able to make money and keep their farm and their family afloat. So it can't be the kind of fooling around that we're doing in biodynamics or organic. They just can't afford it. We have to be able to assure them that it works, and it works every time. Can't be a lot of question. That's where we need the demonstrations, because every place, every climate is a little bit different. Mm. And so we've got to have people out there that are willing to do that pioneering work so that they can then show all of their neighbors exactly what they did, and it worked.
Mm. So your vision is to have a sort of interconnected network of bioregional demonstration centers where you figure out what's right for that watershed, that climate, that soil type,
yep,
that vegetation, and then you act as a sort of, well, yeah, as a demonstration.
House. Yeah. And so, like on my website, there's a section on my website that says success stories. And so everybody who is successful, we want them to write up what they did and, you know, have their name and their email address and their phone number so that people can contact them. So somebody in Poughkeepsie wants to start going down this biological pathway. They go to the website and they find the person closest to them that they could call them up and go to their farm. And, you know, so they find out, you know, I'm living in Poughkeepsie. Well, look at that. There's somebody half a mile away. And they've already been successful at this. So I'm going to go talk to them. How would they know otherwise that that person is being successful and there's a good resource for them to work with, unless there's some way of informing them? So that's one of the purposes of the SFI website, is that that information's on there, and we will hopefully just keep populating it more and more and more. And I don't really care if people are doing permaculture approaches, or if they're doing biodynamics, or they're doing organic, or they're just messing around with the biology. Put the success story up there so other people can come and learn from them.
Excellent. Well,
is there a book that you've written that is a good first way in for people?
Yep. So there's a couple of books. So the Soil Biology Primer, published by the USDA, that's a very good first introduction to overview all the different organisms, you know, some of these ratios of fungi to bacteria. And then there's a book by Jeff Lowenfels called Teaming with Microbes. And that's another really good one. And then to get more specific, more into the kind of gory details of the how-to, 10 Steps to Gardening with Nature, and I wrote that.
Wow. Well, I will certainly be putting this into practice as soon as I get my hands on some land, so thank you very much.
Great.
You've inspired us.
Absolutely. Great.
Yeah, so let me know when you do get some land, I'd love to help you with this.
Fantastic. Yeah.
Because it's really important to have the success stories and have the demonstrations that people can come and take a look at.
Fantastic. Well, Elaine Ingham, thank you very much. This has been wonderful.
Great.
Cheers.
Thank you very much.